I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. The 76th World Health Assembly kicked off in Geneva on May 21st with the theme WHO at 75, Saving Lives, Driving Health for All. During the event, which ends this Tuesday, May 30th, delegates, partner agencies, representatives of civil society, and WHO experts have discussed current and future priorities for public health issues of global importance. Among other things, the World Health Assembly has agreed on the first ever global strategy on infection prevention and control. The strategy provides member states with strategic directions to reduce the ongoing risk of healthcare-associated infections, including those that exhibit antimicrobial resistance. Experts say healthcare-associated infections are among the most frequent adverse events occurring in the context of health service delivery. The strategy's three key objectives are to prevent infection in healthcare, act to ensure infection prevention control programs are in place and implemented, and coordinate infection prevention control activities with other areas and sectors. A man recently died in Namibia of Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever, known as Congo fever, a viral disease transmitted by ticks, said the country's Ministry of Health this week. The ministry said in a statement the case was confirmed on Sunday after testing. The man who died last week was placed in isolation in the capital Windhoek. Health workers have been in contact with a total of 27 identified people, according to health authorities. The case is not necessarily viewed as an outbreak because hemorrhagic fever is endemic to Africa, according to Amash Adalja, an infectious disease physician at Johns Hopkins Hospital and a senior scholar with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
It's in the wildlife population. So I don't necessarily think one would be considered an outbreak. They do get sporadic cases that occur. If there is transmission onward from people that may have come into contact with his blood or body fluids, or if there's more cases occurring because maybe changes in behavior, the tick, or with interactions with certain animals, then I think it would be called an outbreak. I don't necessarily think I would call it an outbreak at this point, but I think it's something where they need to look at the contacts of that patient to make sure that there's no onward transmission and to be aggressive with understanding how this person got infected.
How does this hemorrhagic fever case compare with other hemorrhagic fever outbreaks in Africa?
Well, what's unique about Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever is that it's spread primarily by ticks, whereas other hemorrhagic fevers like Ebola or Marburg are transmitted not through ticks, but through exposure to blood and body fluids. So in that sense, it's very different. This is something that people get infected with in a very different manner. And one of the other unique things about it, you called it Congo fever, but its actual full name is Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever because it was first described in the Crimea and in former Soviet Union in the 1950s. So this also has a wider geographic endemicity than other hemorrhagic fevers, meaning that it's in the Crimea as well as in parts of Africa. There are no vaccines for it. There are some experimental antivirals that people use.
You talked about how it's spread by ticks and, you know, it can come from animals. Is that why this disease is called a zoonosis, or what does that mean exactly?
Zoonosis is a term that means any kind of infectious disease that moves from an animal species into humans. So Ebola is a zoonosis as well. What's different about Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever is that it's vector-borne, meaning that the tick is the vector. So that makes it different versus other hemorrhagic fevers. But all hemorrhagic fevers are zoonosis. They all have animal hosts.
What's the mortality rate of this kind of hemorrhagic fever?
About, 30 to 50% around on average.
That's kind of high. Are people on alert in Namibia and elsewhere?
Well, I think that once there's a case of people, again, this is something that's endemic or that occurs in Africa sporadically. There have been cases in Namibia in the past before. Right now, I don't think there's enough information because we have a single case. So this might be just a single case that came from a tick bite or interaction with some animal. The alert really happens as if there's onward human-to-human spread, meaning that people are getting exposed to blood and body fluids or they're in an area where these ticks are of high prevalence.
That is Dr. Amash Adalja, an infectious disease physician at Johns Hopkins Hospital and a senior scholar with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Now to Zimbabwe, where officials hope vaccinations will tame a cholera outbreak as citizens continue to drink and safe water. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, authorities are urging people to practice good hygiene to contain the waterborne disease.
Zimbabwe Ministry of Health authorities say that cholera has claimed 28 lives since the end of April. Nearly 400 cases have been confirmed and more than 1,400 cases are suspected. Health organizations such as the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights blame the outbreak on the consumption of unsafe drinking water and the flow of sewage in some areas. Jacob Mafume, the mayor of Harare, says he's aware of drinking water and sewage problems.
We are responding to sewage issues as soon as we get a report on them. We are also increasing the water flow. We are also going to take advantage of the polio vaccination to vaccinate against cholera because most of the people who are getting this cholera are unvaccinated people.
Zimbabwe received heavy rains this year and most of its water sources are full. But clean water for drinking and household use is not getting to most citizens' homes because of power cuts and shortages of water treatment chemicals. Fanuel Mushonga says he has not had tap water in his home for 3 weeks. He says he is lucky to have a manual borehole nearby.
If I could get a chance to talk to leadership, I would plead with them to train our students studying to be engineers so that they could pump water from Lake Chivaro to the people in townships, and also to procure water-treating chemicals so that people drink safe water.
Citizens should practice good hygiene, and the government should do more to treat water and inform citizens, says Dr. Nomeni Matara, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights.
We urge the government to continue the surveillance that they've been doing over the past weeks and over the past months so that we detect new epicenters of cholera outbreak. We also urge the government to continue with mass media awareness on the cholera outbreak and on ways people can prevent this cholera outbreak within their homes.
The World Health Organization says the extremely virulent disease is now in 13 African countries. Dr. Otim Patrick Ramadan is the World Health Organization's Regional Health Emergency Officer. He says that hygiene is not enough and that governments must provide clean water and hygienic facilities to eliminate the problem.
That is something that requires a lot of investment and that governments need to proactively work on. Then the second one, of course, is also addressing issues of hygiene of food at the community level, at the household level, and then working, because we have communities or areas where cholera has been endemic and we need to have targeted interventions in those areas.
In 2008 and 2009, a cholera epidemic killed more than 4,000 people in Zimbabwe. According to a U.S. report, the crisis was exacerbated in part by the politicization of water, health, and aid. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
South African health authorities have warned citizens to take extreme precautions as an outbreak of cholera has killed up to 1,000 people and raised fears that it could spread to other parts of the country. Residents of the most affected township, Hammanskraal, just outside Pretoria, have been cautioned not to touch tap water amid strong suspicions that the infection is coming out of their taps. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The cholera outbreak has brought grief to many families and triggered panic across the country. Hammanskraal Township is the worst affected, with residents commuting daily to Pretoria for work and other needs. There are fears it could easily spread to the capital. Dozens have been hospitalized. The local Jubilee Hospital says it has treated over 100 people showing symptoms of cholera such as diarrhea, vomiting, fever, and dehydration. Nomantu Nkomo Ralehoko, a member of the Gauteng Provincial Government's Executive Council responsible for health, spoke to journalists during her visit to the affected areas.
We are going to the communities just to make sure that they drink clean water and they must boil their water when they are drinking it. And the municipality is assisting us with the trucks that are coming to deliver water in the area.
Meanwhile, the communities in Hammerskraal Township are angry over the outbreak and loss of loved ones. For years, they have complained about the various illnesses caused by their visible and clean water, but the calls fell on deaf ears. South Africa's neighbors like Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Malawi have also reported cholera cases, raising concerns that the disease could jump borders. In 2008, South Africa had up to 12,000 cases of cholera after an outbreak that killed thousands in Zimbabwe. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
The fighting in Sudan has destroyed hospitals and medical care in the country, and patients who fled the conflict are desperate for treatment. In the absence of medical aid, a Sudanese pharmacist who fled Sudan in recent weeks is doing what he can to help other refugees at a camp in neighboring Chad. Henry Wilkins reports from Kufron, Chad.
A month ago, Mohammed Adam gathered what medicine he could when he heard the Janjaweed, an armed group known for killing civilians, was about to storm his hometown of Tendelti in West Darfur. He says he loaded the medicine on a horse-drawn cart and rode the kilometre or so across the border to neighbouring Chad. Since then, he has set up a makeshift pharmacy in Kafrun, a refugee site where about 10,000 people live. He says they are most in need of medicine for children because kids are getting sick with infections, diarrhea, coughing, and especially measles. He says most of his patients are children. He says he pays for the medicine his patients receive himself. Medina Ahmed Ishak has just arrived at the pharmacy seeking treatment for her baby, Abdul Razak. She says that Abdul Razak is sick with malaria and diarrhea, and that any food they had is now gone. They don't have enough to eat, yet she prays her son will one day grow up to be a doctor. Since Sudan's conflict began on April 15th, Chad and aid groups have struggled to provide enough food for refugees to eat. Medical aid is scarce too, according to refugees. Inside Sudan, the healthcare system has all but collapsed. This video purports to show a hospital in Khartoum gutted by the fighting. Others in the city are said to have been severely damaged, along with hospitals in West Darfur, where much fighting has taken place. The medical non-profit Doctors Without Borders said Tuesday that its medical facilities had been looted, while a staff member had already been killed in April in the fighting. It says the looting will have life-ending consequences for the Sudanese people. Amir Eltom is the Assistant Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association. He says with the Sudanese government not functioning because of the fighting, his organisation is helping fund the running of some hospitals. A week-long ceasefire that began Monday should allow some medical aid to enter the country.
Some of the hospitals that have been shut down for various reasons are the largest in Sudan, some of the tertiary hospitals that other states referred to. Basically, the fighting has to stop. Otherwise, one catastrophe after the other in different or various fields of medicine will ensue.
Adam says refugees need more help from the international community, however. He asks all non-profits and local communities to help the refugees because they really need it. They have no place to protect themselves from the rain, which helps spread diseases. He is also concerned about the spread of cholera, which could turn into an epidemic, which would be catastrophic. He says he's doing what he can with what little he has. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kafrun, Chad.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. In South Sudan, nurses and midwives in the Lakes State capital Rumbek complain that they are being overworked and underpaid and are calling for better working conditions. One registered nurse working at Rumbek State Hospital says he and his colleagues work hard but feel that their efforts are not being rewarded appropriately. The Lakes State Health Minister says the state government is working with the national government to ensure health workers' salaries are increased by up to 7%, but urges the health workers to be patient. William Sunday Mabor reports from Rumbek.
Isaac Mading is a registered midwife in charge of the maternity ward at Rumbek State Hospital. He says he and other midwives usually work three shifts but receive little pay.
When we are working, you need to be motivated well, and you also need to be encouraged. When you are working with a happy life, this is whereby you continue serving your community. But now, our midwife in Lake State General, we are under-motivated. Our government is not well supporting us in terms of the payment.
Daniel Weth, who is a registered nurse, says he believes he does much work and should be paid better. Midwife and nurses in Lake State earn $280 per month and are asking the state government to increase the salaries to $700 per month. Lewis says such the increase will enable nurses and midwives to pay school fees, buy food for their families, and meet other needs.
Nurses and midwives, they are very recognized worldwide. But due to the payment here in South Sudan, we are not paid well. This one, we are now asking our government, at least we're supposed to be given a chance. Which, if you finish and you get a degree or diploma, you're supposed to be paid very well. And these are the challenges now we are facing. All in all, what I want to request from the government to increase our salaries nowadays, we are really suffering.
Lagos State Health Minister Jacob Akoipir says the state government prioritizes the needs of the health workers. He says the government is committed to improve the working condition for all in Lagos State.
We want to urge all our health workers that the Minister of Health stand with them, the government of Lagos State, under leadership of His Excellency the Governor Rintai Mabor. He wants to make sure that all the health workers are well paid. And this is what we discussed last time with His Excellency the Vice President when he visited the state. We want to increase at least the budget which are allocated for the health from 2% to at least 7%.
Regina Akur, another registered midwife at Rumbek State Hospital, says despite working as a staff supervisor, she earns the same salary as junior staff. Akur says the nurses and the midwives want the government to grant them leave, pay for the overtime work, and allow them to rest on the public holidays like other civil servants.
What we know, we are working on the side of our community. Yes, for sure, but they need also to see, because you need to get like cheap allowances. Because what we are doing here, sometimes we can end up with infection. Midwives are supposed also to be immunized. Like now, some of us are working here, and they even sometimes ending up receiving the baby with a bare hand without any infection prevention control.
A non-profit NGO known as Doctors with Africa pays health workers salaries at Rumbek State Hospital and other health facilities in Lagos State. South Sudan in Focus contacted the NGO for a comment in the story, but official declined to comment. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabur, reporting in Rumbek, Lagos State.
The president of the Uganda Nurses and Midwives Union says the organization is planning to send about 3,000 of its skilled nurses abroad to enable them to seek better paying work. Justus Cherap says the leadership of the group is working on agreements with Western and Asian countries to enable them employ Ugandan nurses. This after saying that the government appears to be unable to employ the more than 5,000 nurses the country produces annually. His remarks also follow local media reports that some employment agencies are planning to send nurses to work in the United Kingdom and the Middle East. To learn more about the plans of the Uganda Nurses and Midwives Union, VOA's Peter Cloti reached its president, Justus Cherop, in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
We produce about 5,000 nurses annually, and the government employs only 28,000 nurses, and yet we have 68,000 nurses who are only on the street. So we are looking at opportunities to export the extra nurses to get a greener pasture or to get a jobs abroad. And we have linked up UK and we have linked up USA to make sure that our nurses whom we produce can get scholar jobs abroad.
Somewhere last year, Gender and Labor Minister Ms. Betty Amongi said that they plan to send nurses and doctors abroad who were not employed by the government. But the Uganda Medical Association challenged the plan, saying there's an alarming shortage of medical workers in many public health facilities in Uganda that the government should first address. Doesn't this sharply contradict another health union in Uganda, this plan that you have?
No. Now, Medical Workers Association, actually, for us, we have a deficit of nurses, we have a deficit of doctors, and what we are looking at, the country cannot sustain, the wage bill cannot sustain to absorb about 30,000 nurses. We now look at another opportunity and say, if we can take nurses abroad, we would have gained because we produce more nurses than our country. Now, we are also encouraging the country to meet the WHO ratio, nurse ratio to patient. And the country, because of the wage bill, it cannot reach to that level. And our sustainability of the country, according to African Declaration in Abuja, they declared that in health system, 15% of the budget of the country should go to the health. Now, in our country, we have only 7.5% located to the health.
Now, Justice, has the government signed off on this plan or arrangement that you are making or you've made?
Yes. The President of the Republic of Uganda and the government of UK has agreed to export nurses, labor nurses to UK. But we are extending to USA, we are extending to UK, and we are extending to Australia and Canada. Whoever, which country wants nurses, we can explain. Only that the government has not come out that when do we begin with this. But for us as a union and labor union, we need to begin immediately because we cannot have a degree nurse redundant at home for 2 years and no job. So we need to export wherever the nurses are needed. We need to export as a union. But government has not yet, they were debating in the parliament that when do we begin this. But the president and the UK government had already agreed that there will be a need of exporting nurses to UK. But for me, I have opened doors as for other countries like Canada, Australia, and the USA and the UK to nurses to go freely and educate, so long as they get the requirements which they need.
I understand there's also a plan to send some of these nurses to the Middle East. I'm sure you understand that there have been a lot of concerns raised by Ugandans who bring back sad news and sometimes uncomfortable news that they are mistreated.
Yes, that is the truth. Because we have been hearing a lot of allegations that the Middle East has been mistreating nurses. But the fact is, I want to clarify this, that those people who go to Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, like Indonesia, Middle East, they go not a professional nurse, but they go as a housemaid.
A meeting of a United Nations committee dedicated to eradicating plastic pollution began in Paris Monday. Plastic piles up from ocean beds to landfills. Manufacturers have begun to shift to biodegradable materials, but the billions of tons of plastic waste already in our environment are here to stay for now. VOA's Arash Arabatsadi has more.
It really doesn't matter where in the world you look. Plastics are a problem. Manufacturers produce about 460 million tons of plastic each year. Less than 10% of that is recycled. The United Nations Environment Program says we could slash plastic waste by 80% in the coming decades using existing technologies and by following the mantra, reduce, reuse, recycle. But scientists and advocates warn the plastics manufacturing industry as it stands is unsustainable long term.
You have to be very careful about unintended consequences. So if there is a new polymer material that is going out into the market, then manufacturers have to think really carefully about the end of life of that material.
Because most of that material ends up in a landfill or in waterways, damaging plant and animal habitats while threatening entire ecosystems. Researchers at University College London are studying how to cut the plastic waste that humans produce. And that includes biotechnology, like deploying plastic-eating bacteria in a small anaerobic digester. In short, it's a device where bacteria break down what's typically organic material, but in this case, plastics.
So we want to reduce those times. We want to reduce the time taken to degrade plastic in anaerobic digesters to bring that into that three-week window, which is what anaerobic digesters run commercially at now.
While advocates support these steps, they say the long fight needs more buy-in from nations serious about cutting plastic waste.
Now, we're talking about China, we're talking about India, Singapore, or any other country. These are the countries that have huge populations. These are the countries that have the huge pollution when it comes to plastic. So if you're talking about any meaningful commitments and desire and seriousness on having a plastic pollution treaty, all countries, all member states must demonstrate that they are committed.
UN scientists estimate that 9.2 billion tons of plastics were produced from 1950 to 2017. About 7 billion tons of that was waste. As the new meeting of the UN-organized Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee on Plastic Pollution begins this week in Paris, demonstrators say the time for action is now. Arash Arabatsadi, VOA News.
Blind and visually impaired people often rely on walking sticks and guide dogs to help them navigate streets and sidewalk. But one Japanese startup is bringing navigation technology directly to their shoes. Tina Trin reports.
For the blind and visually impaired, getting around often means using a guide dog or walking stick. But in Japan, there are helpful clues right beneath your feet. Braille blocks. Yohei Tokuda is the co-founder of Japanese tech startup Ashirase.
It is famous in Japan, so they are everywhere in road in Japan.
These tactile pavement surfaces have spread across the world, guiding users with physical cues they can feel. Japanese startup Ashirase is taking the idea a step further, bringing the external sensations in.
How to realize braille block inside the shoe? This is our first point.
The Ashirase in-shoe navigation system guides users with vibrations and motion sensors placed inside their shoes.
There are three area vibrator inside the one device, and you need to use both devices on both shoes.
With the smart devices connected to an app via Bluetooth, users enter their destination and a route is mapped out. Motion sensors detect the direction a user is heading in and vibrate on either the left or right foot, indicating which way to go. The speed of vibrations also varies.
The tempo of vibration is corresponding to the distance to the corner. When user approach to the corner, tempo of vibration increases.
The developers say these cues allow blind and visually impaired users to focus on gathering other important information about their surroundings. They say with Ashirase, directions are one less thing to worry about.
Ashirase can follow the route so they can focus on the safety.
It's a vision for more freedom and autonomy. Tina Trin, VOA News, Las Vegas.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voanews.com and voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat.